The EU's gas storage will be less than 20% full in February of 2023, assuming a high level of LNG supply in the case of a complete Russian supply shutdown starting from 1st of November 2022. And without demand reductions in place, or if Russian pipeline supply is completely cut. Storage levels drop to 5% of full capacity, assuming low LNG supply, as storage falling to these levels would increase the risk of supply disruptions in the event of a late cold spell this winter. According to the analysis, a reduction of 9% from the average level of the past 5 years in EU gas demand through the winter months would be necessary to maintain gas storage levels above 25% in the case of lower LNG inflows. A reduction in demand of 13% from the 5-year average will be necessary through the winter period to sustain storage levels above 33% in the case of low LNG inflows. The International Energy Agency, the IEA, warned, therefore, gas-saving measures will be crucial to minimize storage withdrawals and keep inventories at adequate levels until the end of the heating season. The announcement of the emergency is likely to heighten fears of blackouts because the United Kingdom relies on gas-fired power plants for the largest share of its electricity supply.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
When it comes to the relationship between the EU and Israel, one thing is evident. The EU comes out defending Palestinians and condemns Israel for its different violations, from settlements to the killing of Palestinians. But words of condemnations are just that, words. For when it comes to doing anything about it, it does absolutely nothing. There is a broad consensus that the EU is not an honest broker when it comes to Israel and Palestine, and that the very DNA of the Israel-EU relationship reveals that on Palestinian rights, Brussels only condemns Israeli illegal acts. Be it in response to the unfounded allegations in the 2021 dossier, which offered no proof to justify the terror label for Palestinian groups, or to the all-frequent military onslaught on Gaza. The EU has done little to hold Israel accountable besides ritual but ineffectual expressions of concern. In fact, the EU recently reiterated its commitment to developing closer diplomatic ties and agreed to resume meetings of the EU-Israel Association Council. Another sign of Europe's somewhat covert support for Israel is a memorandum of understanding between the EU, Egypt, and Israel, where Cairo is set to export Israeli gas to Europe. All this has also shed light on the West's double standards regarding the Palestine-Israel conflict, and this has only been further clarified through the West's support of Ukraine in light of the Russian special military operation there. The world rallied behind Ukraine and left Palestinians frustrated, who witnessed being criminalized and were constantly being told that they don't have the right to resist, or even labeled as terrorists or anti-Semites just for asking for their rights. Despite the long list of horrific human rights violations in Palestine and other atrocities in the world, the West is yet to display a unified response to the Israeli aggressions. But what makes matters worse is the West claims it supports human rights, like for Palestinians, continues to do nothing when it comes to the Israeli violations of Palestinian rights. In 2021, Manu Pineda, the chair of the European Parliament delegation for relations with Palestine, stated that Israel has inflicted brutal violence against Palestinians in Al-Quds who were resisting their forced displacement, so settlers can take their place, adding that this is part of Israel's ongoing attempts to erase the Palestinian presence from the city. But what he said further shows how the EU is actually funding the Israeli violations against Palestinians. He said the EU cannot continue to have an association agreement with Israel and called on the bloc to move to terminate it. This showed that the EU money was being used to fund entities and illegal settlements and to subsidize Israel's arms industry. Yet, in action, none of those promises were kept. Palestinians have been, in essence, ripped off of their rights and been subject to ethnic cleansing, occupation, and oppression for over seven decades now, and the double standard and hypocrisy shown by the West, especially the EU, only demonstrates that fighting military aggression as well as fighting for rights and how it's approached towards or labeled is solely dependent on the identity of the aggressor with no regard to the tragic consequences. So in short, the EU may condemn Israeli acts of violation, but it truly supports Israel. Gaza is under a blockade by Israel, which claims it is the only way to confront the Palestinian resistance who hold power in the area. EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell explained that there is no solution to the West Asia conflict without a very strong commitment on part of the US. Many attempts were made in the past, but at the moment there appears to be no path forward. Such reactions, however, aren't new to Palestinians, as they have on multiple occasions seen the EU and even the UN condemning Israeli actions, including warnings over the mass displacement of Palestinians, but no actions to prevent it. The EU says it supports Palestinians, but continues to further strengthen its ties both politically and economically with Israel. And this only proves that it is not an honest or effective stakeholder in the struggle for Palestinian sovereignty and independence. Its actions have so far only allowed Israel to continue its acts of aggression with complete impunity. When it comes to the Nord Stream pipeline sabotage, a fourth leak has been found. That was enough for a Security Council meeting to take place. But at the end of the session, Russia was blamed for the act of sabotage. Russia and the West are trading blame over this. Although Russia has not accused the US by name, all of its statements are pointing the finger at the US. The same goes for the US and the EU. Both have stopped short of directly accusing Russia. Russia has said that the US president is obliged to answer the question of whether the US carried out its threat.
If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again, then there will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
How will you do that exactly, since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control?
We will, I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
Meanwhile, Washington also dismissed the suggestion and accused Russia of spreading disinformation. While the EU has said the sabotage was deliberate, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said it would be in no one's interest if the leaks were caused deliberately. But Blinken's point that it would be in no one's interest can be argued otherwise. In the case of the U.S., it would reap huge benefits. For example, it would continue selling gas to the EU and make huge profits. Some single shipments are bringing in $200 million U.S. for the U.S. The U.S. is now sending 60% of its liquefied natural gas exports to Europe, up from less than 20% this time a year ago. Meanwhile, the high gas and electricity prices are pushing European manufacturers to shift to the US. This is because there are relatively stable prices in there, with green energy incentives also luring the companies to the US. The US's recently adopted Inflation Reduction Act makes it a particularly attractive destination for companies in the chemicals, batteries, and green energy sectors. It aims to increase manufacturing and level the international playing field by using American incentives to match the competition from overseas. But what about the other parties that are related to Russia's Nord Stream pipeline, namely Russia and the EU? Would either benefit from the act of sabotage on the pipeline? The answer is a resounding no in the case of the EU. In Europe, more and more companies are switching into survival mode. For a lot of them, the time is coming to renew their electricity supply contracts with utilities. And thanks to the energy inflation, these are set to be much higher than the contracts for the current year. Meanwhile, the European Commission has promised to help by capping the revenues of oil, gas, and coal companies. As for Russia, it would lose income, so that would also be ruled out. Russia has said that Europe is now indefinitely deprived of key gas supply routes. It said that it is searching for ways to get the pipelines up and running, but the timeline cannot yet be estimated. So the big winner from the energy crisis in Europe would be the US. Europe's descent into deindustrialization is happening at warp speed. With the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipeline, there is no way back. Europe can no longer import Russian gas, and this means that prices will remain high until Europe builds more energy capacity, and this could take years. High energy prices will, in essence, make European manufacturing uncompetitive. After all, European manufacturers will be forced to pass the higher energy cost to the end user or the consumers. And that is how many European businesses will begin to unravel. According to one analyst, the only logical European response to the threat of widespread deindustrialization is to raise tariffs. This is the only way to balance out prices between more expensive European goods and cheaper foreign goods. One of the consequences, however, is that it will lower living standards, depriving Europeans of cheaper priced goods. In short, this no longer looks like a short-term crisis for Europe. Stories from Europe are like stories once heard in countries that are suffering from high inflation, and resource rations imposed by the state. European companies or factories moving to the US would help the US economic situation. The US is already suffering from high inflation and an energy crunch. The relocation of European manufacturers to the United States will give the US a big advantage by boosting investment and creating jobs. It will also strengthen the country's industrial economy. This will also give the United States a bigger advantage in the face of its increasing military and economic confrontation with China. And in the face of rising competition with Russia and China, having Europe on its side will prove to be a big advantage for the United States. The question is whether the Biden administration knowingly nudged Europe to decouple from Russian energy sources in order to lure European companies toward the influence sphere of Washington.
The wait was finally over. The four regions of Ukraine are not Ukrainian territory any longer, but Russian territory, after referendums were held.
Of course, there were soldiers, but it was not because of forcing the people, but it was to protect us, and not for the people to force them to vote.
It's perfectly understandable, and on the democratic point of view, I don't see anything to say against this referendum.
The residents overwhelmingly voted to join Russia. This was the fight of their lives, said the leader of Donetsk. 3,000 days of fighting, thousands killed due to Ukraine's shelling. Now, lives will be saved. The US, the UK, and the West in general already spoke out against these referendums, which they called a sham.
Russia and the sham referenda and annexations that seem to be proceeding in Ukraine. One, we've been very clear that we are prepared and we will impose additional severe and swift costs on Russia for proceeding with the annexations.
The UK Prime Minister Liz Truss was visibly angry at Russia's formalization. Putin cannot be allowed to alter international borders using brute force. We will ensure that he loses this illegal war. For Russia, this was a big moment. First, it was successful in building a wall that almost entirely blocked NATO's eastward expansion. This would almost make Ukraine a landlocked country, posing another major challenge for Ukraine and the U.S. The Russian President Vladimir Putin's formalization of the referendums, however, more than just that. He took the opportunity to slam the West, the U.S. in particular, from different angles, including cultural values. At the same time, Putin called on Kiev to return to negotiations, emphasizing, however, that Moscow will not discuss the choice made by the Donbas republics, Kherson, and Zaporizhzhia. This poses the question, is Putin open for peace talks in order to end the war? This is a question that the West, in particular the U.S. and the U.S.-backed NATO, need to wrestle with. After all, they have put all their cards in on this conflict. Looking at the U.S. assistance that Ukraine has received, the U.S. tops the list, with the U.K. coming in second. But other countries have also contributed quite a bit militarily to this war. Are they now willing to settle for a negotiated solution? A former Pentagon and CIA official has said that one theory is that Putin, aware that his military is struggling mightily against the stiff Ukrainian resistance, might use the sham boats to claim the mission is accomplished and send his troops home. This might not sit well with the West, since this, in a sense, is a declaration of a win by Putin. Yet the economic crises gripping Europe might be overwhelming for European countries, forcing them to capitulate and say enough is enough, and to opt for a compromise solution before the citizens of the countries rise up against them or protest like they did in France.
Anger is rising in France over the country's deepening economic woes. Hundreds of protesters have gathered to demand higher wages and pensions. Street demonstrations were also held in other French cities in what is the first major strike since Emmanuel Macron won the re-election as president in April. Unions also called for the scrapping of Macron's plans to raise the retirement age from 62 to 65. Protesters are angry over the government's failure to live up to its promises. The unemployment rate in France inched up to 7.4% in the second quarter of 2022, from 7.3% in the previous quarter. The annual inflation rate in France eased to 5.9% in August of 2022, from 6.1% in July, but it is still higher than initial estimates of 5.8%. But France is not the only European country to experience tough economic times. Germany, which is the EU's economic powerhouse, is also experiencing a high inflation rate, which increased to a record 10% in September. The news comes after economic institutes predicted the economy to shrink next year. Soaring price of energy weighs on households and businesses. There are now concerns of widespread bankruptcies and factory shutdowns. And in the UK, Prime Minister Liz Truss is facing tough economic times. She has pressed ahead with her economic plan to cut taxes and insists that she has made the right decision. But this decision is said to make the rich have tax breaks and will increase inequality in the country and weigh down on the middle and poorer classes. The Bank of England has stepped in with a £65 billion emergency bond buying program in the UK as part of efforts to quell a market meltdown. The former governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, has accused Liz Truss's government of undercutting the country's economic institutions.
Imports are obviously going to go up in price. Exporting is going to be more difficult. Added to that, the effects of Brexit, which are coming down the line straight for us. And I think we're going to be in serious trouble over the next couple of years.
I think it's obvious that there's some sort of recession coming, right? If it's not already here, we'll just have to work through it. I think, arguably, you have to keep spending to try and bring it back, but it's difficult to see. I mean, business is still there, right? The work's still happening. Everyone's still recovering from COVID, spending the money they didn't spend. So the work's still there. People are just being more frugal and a bit more considerate.
amid widespread protests, there are now concerns of the rise of far-right groups in Europe. The grim economic outlook in Europe comes amid warnings of a looming economic recession. The head of the World Trade Organization says the world is sliding into a recession due to multiple overlapping crises. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have also downgraded their global growth forecasts. The recession is a result of a number of factors that have compounded each other. The recession has been triggered by an energy crunch, surging food prices, and bottlenecks in global trade.
The world is in a very difficult place at this time. We have a situation in which we are grappling with multiple crises. I often refer to it as a poly-crisis, simultaneous exogenous shocks hitting the world. We have security shocks, we have climate shocks, we have energy shocks, we have food price shocks, and all of this hitting countries at the same time. So we cannot afford to do business as usual.
If energy prices, if there's disruptions during winter, and the energy prices go up even further, we have a scenario in which an increase in 50% of gas prices will lead to a reduction in GDP in Europe by 1.4%. And so this is a huge number. So that means that the European economy for sure will be in recession.
Some of these factors were triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic, but the Ukraine war has made them worse. China's pandemic policies and rampant inflation have worsened the economic outlook. But investors are particularly concerned about the prospect of interest rates in the U.S.
Just as U.S. investors are completely comfortable with the Fed's strategy, there's now this concern that the rest of the world is not following on. So it's a real concern about the resolve of European central banks to fight inflation, and particularly the UK, and how that might spread to others.
If Federal Reserve raises interest rates aggressively, the US could head into a recession, which could have significant ramifications not only for the US, but also its allies in Europe.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The fabricated regime of Israel is a brutal European settler colony that has been targeting Palestinians and is stealing their land since its inception. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Hamid Dabashi, author, in an article published under the heading Gaza on Screen: How Palestinian Truth Implicates All of Humanity. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Telling you the truth, the Israeli regime military or propaganda, from which major US and European media outlets, including the BBC and New York Times, take their cues, or countless Palestinian filmmakers transforming the facts of their experiences into artistic truth? Where do sublime works of art stand vis-a-vis the relentless barrage of falsehoods and propaganda that conquerors habitually spin to justify and camouflage their barbarians? What is a Ghassan Kanafani novella, a Mona Hatoum artwork, a Mahmoud Darwish poem, or an Ilya Soleiman film next to Israeli regime tanks, fighter jets, smart bombs, assassination squads, nuclear submarines, or sharpshooters? When an empire is vast and variegated like the U.S., it can afford both military thuggery around the globe and ingenious filmmakers such as Stanley Kubrick, Oliver Stone, or the Hugh brothers to dismantle the lies of those conquests. When a settler colony like the fabricated regime of Israel is too small to afford such complexities, it just bombs, maims, and murders, while its propaganda machinery does the camouflaging in manipulated news coverage. In the Palestinian case, there is no military to speak of. What they have on their side are facts and truth. Truth that would have gone unheard were it not for the Palestinian poets, journalists, scholars, artists, novelists, and filmmakers. But isn't this comparing apples and oranges? The military might of a settler colony to the works of art that those under its occupation produce? But that amounts to asymmetrical warfare. Palestinians have no military, air force, or navy. The Zionists do. Palestinians do not receive billions of dollars in military aid from the U.S. and Europe. The Zionists do. Palestinians wage only a form of guerrilla warfare imposed on them by cruel fate. Militarily, Palestine is no match for the fake regime of Israel. But artistically, aesthetically, morally, and imaginatively, the Zionist regime is no match for Palestine. Take the most recent Zionist regime atrocities in Gaza earlier this month. A relentless blockade and repeated invasions of the Gaza Strip culminated in yet another war of aggression that terrorized Palestinians, destroyed their homes, and denied them their livelihoods. What is the function of Palestinian filmmakers in times of such Israeli terror? The dominant US and UK media consider themselves to be truly objective and fair when they pronounce that there are two sides of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as they claim. But there are not two sides of the Zionist regime's systematic, purposeful, and relentless occupation and theft of Palestine and the murder of Palestinians. There is only one truth, which has no sides. The fabricated regime of Israel is a brutal European settler colony that has been targeting Palestinians and stealing their land since its inception. A key element of this resistance has been cinema. With around 2 million inhabitants on some 365 square kilometers, Gaza is among the most densely populated places in the world. Many observers call it the largest open-air prison. The fabricated regime of Israel has systematically used the territory to test its most recent weaponry, causing death, destruction, and despair to Palestinian civilians. The choice of Gaza as the theme of a film festival was emblematic of the larger Palestinian question, in light of their status as victims of European colonial conquest. In Gaza's Metaphor, a 2016 collection edited by Dina Matar and Helga Tauli-Suri, insightful essays describe how Gaza has become a metaphor for the larger Palestinian struggle. It is a floating signifier, open-air prison, terror, resistance, occupation, siege, trauma. But we should not be trapped inside such metaphors. Rather, we must see through them. Their simple truths reference the disposition of a nation and its landscape of history and humanity. Palestinian art and cinema receive, recast, and reassert that history and humanity. Gaza is not a metaphor for cruel world. Gaza is that world. The battle the Israelis have lost is not a battle between two narratives. It is a battle between truth and charlatanism. More specifically, it is between the aesthetic sublimation of Palestinian truth through visual and performing arts and the banal propaganda administered by the Zionist regime spin doctors. For example, after Israeli regime forces killed more than a dozen children in their latest operation, the Zionist propaganda initially alleged Islamic Jihad was to blame for most of its deaths. There is no aesthetic sublimation of the falsehoods of Zionism, for it is bereft of any truth to raise the aesthetic sublimation. It has lost the uneven battle between the Zionist regime lies and Palestinian truth. Palestinian and other journalists, Arabs and non-Arabs, Muslims and non-Muslims, have worked tirelessly to expose these lies and report the bare facts. Gaza, the names and faces of the 17 Palestinian children killed in Israel's onslaught, reads one recent Middle East Eye headline. At least 49 Palestinians were killed and more than 360 wounded as Israeli airstrikes rained down on the besieged strip over 3 days. There is no corporate or mainstream monopoly over the news anymore. Pro-Israel outlets such as the BBC and New York Times are just a click away from countless other outlets that are doing what those institutions have failed to do. But the facts that journalists expose never speak for themselves, they must yield to the imaginative power of the arts to find a universal tongue that the world understands best. Gaza on screen is no mere corrective lens for Zionist, European, and American propaganda. It is a perfect mirror of a heroic defiance of cruel fate. In the face of that mirror, we cannot be fatalistic, for we are witnessing a Palestinian truth that implicates the rest of humanity, and the Israelis in particular, should they ever dare to face that mirror.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayru din Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
La, 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 la.
going to talk about some of the Islamic laws about medical issues and conditions, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography, and we'll be back. Don't go away. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Okay, Sheikh Javid, let me ask you this question regarding the Islamic laws about, the medical cases and scenarios. Is it permissible to look at the pictures of non-Muslims usually found in the books of medicine? We all know that, these books include a lot of naked or semi-naked pictures, or photos of human beings, whether male or female. Yeah. So the question is that, is it permissible to look at them, especially when we are talking about doctors or doctors-to-be? So the interns who want to become, future doctors need to gain experience by looking at, let's say, the body of human beings so that they would be able to diagnose some diseases, right? So what's the ruling about it?
Well, looking at those pictures is not permissible for the laity, for common individuals, mm-hmm. because common individuals have nothing to do with specializing or gaining experience or acquiring knowledge of medicine and so on and so forth. Of course, the question relates to people looking at those pictures who are, for example, maybe partially or fully naked, men or women, And these are medical students who want to gain experience. Of course, Ayatollah Khamenei says that when it comes to such people, there is no objection to seeing these pictures, provided that it's done without questionable intent, you know, without the intention of seeking pleasure, without mm-hmm. lustful intention, because that's not permissible. If the intention of the student who is gaining experience is to acquire knowledge, and his intention is just to see, to check the picture, and to see, for example, the anatomy, if I'm correct, of the person, there's no objection, you know. And also, it's very much important that one does not fear of falling into a sin. Mm-hmm. If one is confident that he is not going to fall into a sin as a result of seeing or looking at those pictures, there is no objection to him seeing or looking at those pictures with the intention of acquiring knowledge and gaining experience.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid is still our guest speaker in this program. We are talking about Islamic laws about the medical issues. Well, Sheikh Javid, you know, we apart from the different sexual or gender orientation that people have, but some people are hermaphrodites. All right.
Yes.
So, what's the Islamic law about? Undergoing an operation for a hermaphrodite person to become either man or a woman?
Yes, there are people around the world, but their number is few and far between, as far as I know, mm-hmm. who suffer from this kind of gender complication or anomaly. And they do want to belong to either sex, male or female. So some Muslims who suffer from this complication would like to know whether this is permissible to undergo an operation or a surgical operation or not. Yes, Ayatollah Khamenei says that there is no objection to undergoing such an operation, provided that one avoids haram preliminaries or haram preliminary steps, because this may involve or include some preliminary steps, and these preliminary steps might be haram, you know. But you know, as we discussed in one of the previous episodes, when it becomes absolutely necessary, when being a she-male, for example, mm-hmm. makes life for the individual extremely and unbearably difficult, then that person has the right and the excuse to turn to a doctor, to a specialist for surgical operation to get rid of this problem. Mm-hmm. And of course, both the doctor as well as the patient must suffice with the necessity, mm-hmm. with whatever necessary. They should avoid haram preliminaries, haram steps, haram preliminary steps.
Sheikh Javid, you know, when we are talking about laws or Islamic laws and rulings, Sometimes we need to, ask about those situations or those standards which are supposed to be met or fulfilled on the part of the patient, for example, a woman in labor. And sometimes we need to know as, for example, a staff or a personnel working in the hospital doing so, right? Or dealing with, for example, the mothers-to-be. Right. So what are those requirements? What is it that we know that required of a woman in labor, and what is required of nursing staff when it comes to, for example, the pregnant people or the patients, especially we are talking about female patients, and they are, somehow, or they need to see, for example, some of the parts of the bodies of the patients.
You're right. It is not permissible for the nurses to deliberately and intentionally mm-hmm. look at the private parts of a woman in labor unless it is necessary. And of course, the same goes for the doctor, who should avoid looking at the body of the patient or touching it unless it is necessary. So necessity is the criterion. Necessity is the standard, mm-hmm. which must be followed and adhered to everywhere by both nurses and by doctors and staffers and those who work in the hospital. As for the patient himself, herself is mm-hmm. concerned, for example, yes. the woman who is being treated and who is, for example, in the labor room, mm-hmm. She is giving birth to a child. She should also do whatever necessary to cover herself, and she should not uncover all parts of her body when only one part must be uncovered. So she should not take off her clothes and expose herself to the doctors, to the people around her, when she just needs to maybe uncover only one part of her body. Mm-hmm. So she must also understand that she should suffice to the necessary extent and not go and must not go beyond the limit.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice answers to these questions around the medical issues in this program, Islamic Laws. And thank you, my dear listeners, for being with us and tuning in to our radio. IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden's wrong policies have caused many immigrants to be harassed and tortured at the American borders and even spend a long time in detention centers. Many analysts believe that Joe Biden is doing the same wrong Trump's policies against immigrants. These policies have put the lives of many immigrants in danger, and even human rights groups have reacted to U.S. President's immigration policies. In this regard, we have taken a look at some of the world press and news agencies to shed more light on the issue. Stay tuned, please. The Truth Out website explains more about the wrong immigration policies by the U.S. administration, saying hopes for abolishing one of U.S. most harmful immigration policies, including deportation following incarceration in the criminal legal system or double punishment, are withering as the Biden administration continues to snub immigration reform. According to a recent Syracuse University report, 3,481 immigrants are currently in removal proceedings because of criminal charges, and many of them were seized upon their release from prison before they could take even a single breath in freedom. And while that number is on track to be less than last year, advocates warn that without changing the underlying laws, rules, and policies, what goes down this reporting period can go up in the next. Heidi Altman, Director of Policy for the National Immigrant Justice Center, NIJC, told Truthout, "The numbers are still astronomical in terms of sheer numbers of people deported from their loved ones after a conviction or arrest," adding, "There are many ways this could be done even without congressional action through reversal of harmful Board of Immigration Appeals precedent, through rulemaking to allow greater access to bond hearings for those detained on the basis of criminal convictions, through processes to allow those unjustly deported to be returned, and or through policy memos and training that requires officers to consider the racial bias inherent in the criminal legal system when making detention and deportation decisions. But none of that has happened. Instead of being returned to their families and communities for re-entry to society, they are often held 6 months or more in private for-profit detention facilities and then deported to countries where they may not have lived for decades, know no one, and do not speak the language." WTTW Channel 11 is a PBS member television station in Chicago, Illinois. The TV channel's website has published an article concerning this issue, saying the U.S. Supreme Court has certified its ruling allowing the Biden administration to end the Migrant Protection Protocol's policy, better known as Remain in Mexico. The policy was a part of former President Donald Trump's border policy, forcing migrants seeking asylum in the U.S. to wait in Mexico for hearings. In June, a Supreme Court decision overruled a lower court that forced the policy to be reinstated in December. But while President Joe Biden previously tried to end the policy, there has been little comment thus far on when his administration might officially follow through. Gladys Molina Alt, executive director of the Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights, said she has spent time along the U.S.-Mexico border and the situation remains very difficult for the migrants in limbo. Molina Alt said, "What I have seen on the ground is families, parents, we talked about having to make a difficult decision on whether they remain in Mexico waiting for their cases to be processed or make that difficult decision to have their kids across the border by themselves while they remain in Mexico. So family unity is something that we've seen be an issue at stake on the ground." She said, "We've also heard both who are in these MMP PP camps talk about the security issues that they face, the kidnapping that happens, the rapes that happened, the violations of human rights for them as migrants in Mexico that take place. In addition to criticisms from the human rights organizations of the Joe Biden administration in continuing Donald Trump's wrong policies toward immigrants, some American officials have also criticized Biden administration's wrong policies toward immigrants. According to a New York Post report, the chief of the U.S. Border Patrol blamed President Biden's wrong immigration policies for sparking the surge of illegal immigrants crossing into the U.S. Raul Ortiz made the frank admission that the administration's wrong policies are to blame in a recorded deposition that is part of a lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security by Florida Attorney General Ashley Moody. The whistleblower.org says while many public health experts urge the Biden administration to end the use of Title 42 in immigration cases, it remained government policy to do so until April, when the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, finally announced its termination. But just days before the CDC order was to take effect on May 23rd, a Trump-appointed general judge in Louisiana blocked the lifting of Title 42, claiming it violated administrative law and would cause irreparable harm. Yet opposition to the lifting of Title 42 isn't solely coming from Trump appointees and Republicans. For example, the Public Health and Border Security Act, which would require all COVID-19-related national states of emergency to be lifted before Title 42 is officially terminated, was introduced in April by Senators James Lankford, Republican of Oklahoma, and Kristen Sinema, Democrat of Arizona, along with nine other senators, including Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia. Dawn Wooten, a single mother of five, used to work as a full-time nurse at the Irvin County Detention Center in Osceola, Georgia, which was operated by the private contractor LaSalle Corrections. Though she was not officially terminated by her employer, she wasn't called back to work after she began speaking out about unimaginable atrocities being committed against immigrant detainees there. Wooten shared disturbing accounts of medical misconduct at the center, including the refusal by authorities to screen detainees for COVID-19 and the destruction of medical records. Unfortunately, these types of abuses at detention facilities aren't isolated incidents. According to Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, CRU, and the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU of Florida, the Glades County Detention Center in Moorhaven, Florida, has a history of radicalized violence, sexually abusive behavior, medical neglect, and inhuman treatment of immigrants. CRU and the ACLU of Florida filed a federal lawsuit in April against ICE and the National Archives and Records Administration, accusing Glades officials of deleting surveillance videos that could verify claims of abuse by detainees. The Truth Out website wrote in June 2021, Illinois passed laws that banned police from assisting ICE in making arrests and ended private civil detention facilities in the state. Following its lead, other states are starting to move legislation to protect their immigrant communities from double punishment. Most notably, the California legislature is considering the Vision Act, and advocates far and wide are excited that its potential passage in a populous and politically important state could lead other states to close the prison to deportation pipeline and further decriminalize immigration. The Vision Act would prohibit collaboration with ICE to remove people who are being released from prison to jail. Under it, immigration status will no longer be used as a determining factor in how people are treated by state and local agencies and its courts. It would also abolish certain discriminatory record-keeping and reporting requirements. According to the latest published statistics, U.S. authorities arrested more than 221,000 people at the Mexican border in May alone, which is the highest number in 1 month in more than two decades. Experts have cited extreme poverty, rampant violence, and natural disasters